Just after dark that day, when one watch had retired below, a clamor was heard in the forecastle, and the two trembling traitors running up besieged the cabin door, saying they durst not consort with the crew. Entreaties, cuffs, and kicks could not drive them back, so at their own instance they were put down in the ship's run for salvation. Still no sign of mutiny reappeared among the rest. On the contrary, it seemed that mainly at Steelkilt's instigation they had resolved to maintain the strictest peacefulness, obey all orders to the last, and when the ship reached port, desert her in a body. But in order to ensure the speediest end to the voyage, they all agreed to another thing, namely, not to sing out for whales in case any should be discovered. For spite of her leak and spite of all her other perils, the town ho still maintained her mastheads, and her captain was just as willing to lower for a fish that moment as on the day his craft first struck the cruising ground, and Radney the mate was quite as ready to change his berth for a boat and with his bandaged mouth seek to gag in death the vital jaw of the whale. But though the lakeman had induced the seamen to adopt this sort of passiveness in their conduct, he kept his own counsel, at least till all was over, concerning his own proper and private revenge upon the man who had stung him in the ventricles of his heart. He was in Radney the chief mate's watch, and as if the infatuated man sought to run more than halfway to meet his doom after the scene in the rigging, he insisted, against the express counsel of the captain, upon resuming the head of his watch at night. Upon this, and one or two other circumstances, Steelkilt systematically built the plan of his revenge. During the night, Radney had an unseamanlike way of sitting on the bulwarks of the quarter-deck, and leaning his arm upon the gunwale of the boat which was hoisted up there, a little above the ship's side. In this attitude, it was well known, he sometimes dozed. There was a considerable vacancy between the boat and the ship, and down between this was the sea. Steelkilt calculated his time, and found that his next trick at the helm would come round at 2 o'clock, in the morning of the third day from that in which he had been betrayed. At his leisure, he employed the interval in braiding something very carefully in his watches below. "What are you making there?" said a shipmate. "What do you think? What does it look like?" "Like a lanyard for your bag, but it's an odd one, seems to me." "Yes, rather oddish," said the lake man, holding it at arm's length before him. "But I think it will answer." "Shipmate, I haven't enough twine. Have you any?" But there was none in the forecastle. "Then I must go get some from old Rad." And he rose to go aft. "You don't mean to go a-begging to him," said a sailor. "Why not? Do you think he won't do me a turn when it's to help himself in the end, shipmate?" And going to the mate, he looked at him quietly and asked him for some twine to mend his hammock. It was given him. Neither twine nor lanyard were seen again. But the next night an iron ball, closely netted, partly rolled from the pocket of the lakeman's monkey jacket as he was tucking the coat into his hammock for a pillow. 24 hours after, his trick at the silent helm, nigh to the man who is apt to doze over the grave always ready dug to the seaman's hand, that fatal hour was then to come, and in the foreordaining soul of Steelkilt the mate was already stark and stretched as a corpse with his forehead crushed in. But, gentlemen, a fool saved the would-be murderer from the bloody deed he had planned. Yet complete revenge he had, and without being the avenger. For by a mysterious fatality, heaven itself seemed to step in to take out of his hands into its own the damning thing he would have done. It was just between daybreak and sunrise of the morning of the second day, when they were washing down the decks, that a stupid Tenerife man, drawing water in the main chains, all at once shouted out, "There she rolls! There she rolls! Jesu, what a whale!" It was Moby Dick.
"Moby Dick?" cried Don Sebastian. "Saint Dominic, sir sailor, but do whales have christenings? Whom call you Moby Dick?"
A very white and famous and most deadly immortal monster, Don. But that would be too long a story.
"Now, how?" cried all the young Spaniards, crowding. "Nay, Dons, Dons, nay, nay, I cannot rehearse that now. Let me get more into the air, sirs." "The chicha, the chicha!" cried Don Pedro. "Our vigorous friend looks faint. Fill up his empty glass."
"No need, gentlemen. One moment, and I proceed. Now, gentlemen, so suddenly perceiving the snowy whale within 50 yards of the ship, forgetful of the compact among the crew, in the excitement of the moment the Tenerife man had instinctively and involuntarily lifted his voice for the monster, though for some little time past it had been plainly beheld from the 3 sullen mastheads. All was now a frenzy. "The white whale! The white whale!" was the cry from captain, mates, and harpooneers, who, undeterred by fearful rumors, were all anxious to capture so famous and precious a fish, while the dogged crew eyed askance and with curses the appalling beauty of the vast milky mass that, lit up by a horizontal spangling sun, shifted and glistened like a living opal in the blue morning sea.